Welcome to the American Shakespeare Center's podcast of Dr. Ralph Presents A Midsummer Night's Dream. This lecture, delivered by Dr. Ralph Allen Cohen, American Shakespeare Center co-founder and director of mission and Gonder Professor of Shakespeare and Performance at Mary Baldwin College, was recorded before a live audience at the ASC's Blackfriars Playhouse in Stanton, Virginia on April 11th, 2012.
Hi.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for being here. It's great to see you. I'm Cass Morris. I'm in the Education Department here at the ASC, and I'm here to introduce to you Dr. Ralph Allen Cohen, who is the co-founder and director of mission of the ASC, and he also founded the Mary Baldwin Master of Letters, Master of Fine Arts in Shakespeare and Performance right up the hill. So he's going to tell you about A Midsummer Night's Dream tonight. So
thank you very much, Cass. Thanks. Where are you guys from?
JMU.
You're from JMU. Whose students are you? Are you Bob's?
Yes, Bruce Johnson.
How many of Bob Jones? Okay.
No, did he? Bruce
Johnson. Oh, you're Bruce Johnson. Is Bruce here?
No,
I taught there for 30 years. So, and the company that started this it was JMU students. So, all came out of JMU. So, hello JMU. I also a studies abroad program. I started that, and my wife still works there. Have any of you been abroad, gone into OIP? Well, you can say hello to Judy Cohen when you do. So, how many of you have never been in this room before? Raise your hands, please. Isn't it pretty? It's really pretty, isn't it? And the work on it is very good, and you've come to a very special play tonight. The crowds vary, as some of you know. The crowds vary. We've had as few as, how many would you say, Eleanor? How many? Eight. We've had as few as eight. We've had as many as 60. This is a big crowd. We don't have enough handouts for everybody, so we're going to ask that everybody share a handout when you get them, which then there's some reading involved, so it's going to not be great, but we'll do the best we can. But there's one person in the room that, see this book? How many of you who've come to this have seen this book before? Raise your hands if you've been here and seen this book when I brought this one in. Well, Eleanor's raising her hand, right? You've seen this book, right? You've seen this book. Right. This book was given to me. How long ago did you give me this book, Paula? Do you want to say? 40 years ago you gave me this book. Paula was in the very first class I ever taught at Duke University, and she's here today. So it's very exciting for me. So I was very excited, even though I knew there might just be three, because one of them would have been Paula, and that would have been great. So it's great to have her here. Tonight, you're going to see Midsummer Night's Dream. I'd like some help already. If somebody would help me hand these out, would you help me with these, Frank? And again, share if you're with, especially if you're with a significant other of some sort, share. What I normally do is sort of just set the scene by saying where the play comes in Shakespeare's career. This play is written around 1595. Most interesting thing to me about the play in terms of its date is its relationship to Romeo and Juliet. I really, really want to think that this play was written after Romeo and Juliet. And it could have been. It very well could have been. They're both written about the same time. If you look at Shakespeare's career as essentially a 20-year career from 1590 to 1610, which is probably, he probably started 89, and he probably ended, and he did end 11, where this final last play, then this comes really a quarter of the way into his career, so you could say it's early, if you wanted to. But I will say this about this play. There are plays that I care more for. No, I can't even quite say that. There are deeper plays, maybe. There's nothing more perfect than a play you're going to see tonight. This is as perfect as it gets in terms of drama. And by perfect, what I mean is it just works sort of perfectly. It's really kind of hard. I hope the actors don't prove me wrong, to screw this one up. And there are a lot of reasons for that. The play is built around the idea of audience. It's built around the idea of putting on a play. So, and then it's built around the idea of putting on a play with amateurs. And the final thing that happens is the amateurs put on a play. And I have been involved in at least 25 of these productions as an advisor or something, or you know, close to these productions, but also with, you know, outside of American Shakespeare Center, outside of JMU, with my kids' high school class sort of thing. And bad cannot even describe the first two-thirds of the play when a high school, when a bunch of high school kids who don't know what they're saying do it. But brilliant can't come close to describing how great it is when they get to putting on their own play, because you're bad. And that's what that play is about, being bad, not knowing how to put on a play. So it's kind of this kind of bulletproof thing that Shakespeare built. But it's so much more than that. And because I didn't know I was going to have so many people here, thank you, Bob Jones, I had decided to sort of move past the last time I talked about this play. I talk about this play a lot. I talk about each play one time while it's here on our stage each year. So one time. So each play, each title. But Midsummer Night's Dream is money. So we do it a lot. Okay? Which means I talk about it. So those of you who have been here before will hear something about the second page on the handout that I've said before. And what I thought I wanted to do for you guys was to go beyond that a little bit. And so this is what I'd like to do. I'd like to talk about a speech that's in the play. The story of the play is so completely obvious and easy, no one needs me to do plot. Okay? But the structure of the play is remarkably sophisticated. And it's all about drama. It's all about putting on a play. And it's all about how brilliant you as an audience is. If brilliance is the ability to imagine anything, you're brilliant. Right? And this play keeps showing you that. Again and again and again, it shows you that. It is, as I like to say, structured kind of like a dream. The opening scene is set in Athens. So in Athens is like, you know, the home, you know who Athena is. Right? It's all about the mind. Its favorite god was Apollo. He's all about the law and light, you know, and order. And it all starts there with a guy who's marrying a king who's marrying a woman. And these names they are using are legendary names, Theseus, Hippolyta. So when you start to watch this play, you go, oh. And I'm thinking of the first audience. They didn't know what this was. They go in and go, oh, this is heroic drama, because we got Theseus and we got Hippolyta. So they do what they think they're supposed to do. You get ready, you know, come in for some heroic drama. So there's going to be inflated language, you know, and there is. And right away you'll hear, they sound like Shakespeare. They sound like a classical play. And they are supposed to be. They're not hard. They just sound formal, you know. Our nuptial hour draws on apace. Can anybody tell me what that means? Our nuptial hour draws on apace. It's almost time to get married, right? It's not hard. None of the words are all hard. We know nuptial, we know hour, we know drawn, we know apace. That's no problem. There's no problem with it. It just sounds kind of, you know. And she doesn't seem as excited about that as possible. So we're set for one play. And then knock, knock, into the room comes another play. And the play comes in with two young men in love with the same woman. She doesn't love one of them, but the father loves the one she doesn't love. And so he's come in, and he wants her to marry the guy he chose, and he's asked the Duke to do it. And right away, the language changes a little, and you'll kind of hear that. You'll hear it in some very odd ways. In fact, I want to point to one moment for a second, and that is, after the father says all the things, all the reasons she's got to marry Demetrius and not Lysander, all those reasons, including if you don't, as your father, I get to kill you. That's a nice one. And, you know, after he said all those things, Theseus, very aware that his new bride-to-be is watching him, turns to Hermia, the girl that they both love, and says about the guy she doesn't love, Demetrius is a worthy gentleman. And this little girl, in front of the king, does not say, begging your highness's pardon, and go into a speech like that. This little girl says something that for the original audience, they would have dropped their jaws. She goes, so is Lysander. That's what she says. That's her line. You know, Mamet could have written it, right? Completely in your face kind of line. So now we're not watching, we're no longer watching stately comedy. We're now watching, stately drama, heroic drama. We're now watching a romantic comedy. And that's cool. And then knock, knock, in comes Bottom and his crew of mechanicals, and they're going to put on a play. And they all have names that really never were in Athens, like Nick Bottom is not an Athenian name, right? Names like that, Snout, Flute, crazy. They come in, and they're going to put on a play, and it's farce. And you go, oh, okay, wait a second. I thought I'd come for one thing, now I'm seeing something else. And you know what? Not one audience member I have ever seen in my life has gotten up and said, I'm out of here. I thought this was heroic drama, and then I thought it was romantic comedy, and now it's farce. Bye-bye! Not a soul has ever said that. No, what they will do is go, oh, this is cool. That's what they do. And then, knock, knock, over hill, over dale, income, fairies. Okay? So what happened to this play? So this play is like, and the fairy. So I always say it's kind of like falling asleep. When I get in bed, you're going to go to bed and you're thinking about the day. You can't help yourself, you think about the day. I take medicine so I don't think about the day. But you're going to think about the day, and you're remembering things, and you're quite awake, and that's your conscious self, and that's Athens. But somewhere along the line, you remember a conversation and a person, maybe, and then you start actually thinking about that person, and you're no longer where you were exactly. You're thinking about that person, but you're kind of awake. You're not asleep yet. You're kind of awake, but your mind's drifted a tiny bit. And you start thinking about that person, and then maybe that person is suddenly no longer that person exactly, but the face of the foil on a Hershey's Kiss. And the foil and the stuff in the stuff, and the chocolate starts to melt out of the Hershey Kiss, and suddenly you're in a chocolate river, and you're being, floating downstream, and you can't, and you know what's going to happen next to you, and all of a sudden you're landing on an island where everybody is playing leopard guitars. Only you're one of the guitars, and you've never seen what it's like to be a guitar and to look through the strings of the guitar at people, maybe even naked, around a chocolate river. That's an odd thing. But you have all had dreams weirder than that, right? This play will take you, without your objection, to a scene in which the Queen of Fairies will be making love to a man with an ass's head. And nowhere along the line we say, stop, time out, this is not what I came to see. That's how crazy this play is. It's a very amazing play. And it's perfect little play. It's great because it's all about theater. That's what theater can do for you. And see, this set, look at it. It's very beautiful. But at a regular theater, you'd have come in to see a play about an Elizabethan, something Elizabethan, and it would change. No, this is it. So this is going to be your forest. You have a run around a forest here. Lights will stay the same. And everything you do with your brain will be the special effects machine. That's cool. So let's look at that second speech, the second sheet. So look at the second sheet. There is a moment in the speech. There's so many magical things in this play. And one of the magical things in this play is there's a character we never even see. Because it turns out the king and queen of fairies are arguing over, because I keep telling you all these interrupting, knock, knock, here come the king and queen of fairies. We already had the regular fairies, but now here come the real ones. And what they are arguing about is a little changeling boy that he wants that she has. Now, what is the little changeling boy? I don't know. All I know is don't ever stage it with the little changeling boy, because it's one of those great little mysteries at the center. And this is the speech in which she explains to him why she's not going to give back that changeling boy. So this is really, and a lot of people will cut this speech. And if you look at the title of this page, I pulled this off of my computer for you today because one of my favorite students out of the MFA program was going to do a one-hour version of this play and was cutting this speech, and I went into hyperspace. And I sent her this document. I said, you cannot cut this particular speech. Anything else but not this speech. I think this is one of the most magical speeches ever written. So Oberon says, somebody be Oberon for me and just read that. And read it manfully, please. Anybody? Come on.
I do but beg a little changeling boy to be my henchman.
Set your heart at rest. Isn't that a great start? Set your heart at rest. What does that sound like she's going to say? You can have him. Set your heart at rest. And then what Shakespeare loves is 180s, 180 degrees. The fairyland buys not the child of me. So, no. Her mother was a votress of my order. And in the spiced Indian air by night, full often hath she gossiped by my side and sat with me. What's a votress? What's a votress? She was a votress of my order. What's an order?
Basically a nun.
Huh?
Basically a nun.
Yeah, an order is what? An order. What's an order? Right. If you're a priest, your order. So she, a votress is someone who's like a priestess of your order. So she's one of my, she's a votress of my order. Thank you. That's the one hard word in the whole thing. But it's votress of my order. A votress of my order. Which, by the way, without him saying anything, gives to that character, has made her a priest. I mean, has made her a god. She was a votress of my order. She was one of my worshipers. She was a votress of my order and sat with me. For often had she gossiped, we're going to go back over the words in a second, by my side, and sat with me on Neptune's yellow sands, marking the embarked traders on the flood. I got to tell you, I'm not going to go back over. I'm just going to talk about it now. There are so many surprises as you go through a speech. And this is the problem with Shakespeare. Because he is Shakespeare, we read this stuff and we go, oh, well, it must be great. And we don't really hear it right. What we should be going is like that first line, set your heart at rest. Sounds like, yeah, you can have the kid. But if you know, but we're not listening like that. We're listening like we're listening to Shakespeare. So we're kind of like, what's the whole thing going to do? But if you listen to the words, the fairyland buys not the child of me. And a good actor will make you know, wait a second, that's not what she just said. That's something different. And in his mother was a votress of my order. And I believe that could be acted, by the way, to show what a votress is. She was a votress of my order. You know, like Cass is a votress of my order. She introduced me, right? Okay. As a votress of my order. And in the spiced Indian air by night. What kind of language is that? Help me. Just any word. Quick. Rorschach test. Spiced Indian air by night. Somebody. What?
Exotic.
Beautiful word. Exotic. It's exotic. Any of you watch Pardon the Interruption with Michael Wilbon and Tony Kornheiser? Any of you guys watch that? It's a great sports show. They have a word thing where they supply the word. They have to come up with an adjective like that. Exotic. It's exotic. And then suddenly out of this, and we're sitting on golden sands and we're talking Neptune. Why is Neptune an exotic word? It's a sea, but what else? Well, who is Neptune? It's a god. Talking gods and everything. And what's the next line? Marking. Now, marking's an odd word because marking means to look at. But it's also very much about marks and measuring. But we don't realize we're going there yet. Marking, what are they looking at? They're looking at sailing ships that are carrying cargoes. That's what they're doing. They're looking at human beings doing commerce. That's what they're enjoying. On the flood, where we have laughed to see the sails conceive. And this image is almost unbelievably good. Write these two lines and die, and you would have been great, right? when we have laughed to see the sails conceive, see that image? And grow big-bellied with the wanton wind. Is that an image or what? So great, big-bellied with the wanton wind. And then just when you think it couldn't get any better, which she, who? That votress, with pretty and with swimming gait. Can I just say swimming gait is an oxymoron? Because gait is something you do when you, and swimming, you're not walking. But she, in swimming gait, following her womb, then rich with my young squire. Aha, that's the boy we had been hearing about. Her womb, then rich with my young squire, would imitate. Who would she imitate? She'd be imitating who? Who's she imitating? Remember, it's way back there, but who's she imitating? The ships with their bellies. And sail upon the land to fetch me. And my favorite word, this is the word for today, trifles. Fetch me trifles and return again as from a voyage, rich with merchandise. And I've done a color code thing here so you can see all the different things about money that you don't expect, and gossiping, a word you don't expect. Gossip's such a great word. Gossiping at my side. And the way that gets mixed with the exotic, it is magnificent. And we don't even realize we're going through all these things, and return again as from a voyage, rich with merchandise. But she, being mortal, of this boy did die. Oh, this is interesting. Mortal woman, immortal father. All right, where have we heard that one before? Okay? I mean, it's there. It's buried in there. There it is, right? Did die, and for her sake, and these are all one-syllable words, so that the actress can get her teeth around them. And for her sake, do I rear up that her boy, and for her sake, I will not part with him. What a speech, okay? What I love about this speech is it's about trifles. It's what you're doing tonight. Some of you are doing it for Bob Jones' homework. But the rest of you are here for a trifle. This play is a trifle. Plays are trifles. I have wonderful daughters. One of them's particularly good. The other two are okay. One of the daughters said, was talking to me. One time we went out to dinner, one of those moments when you're like with your child and you're actually supposed to talk to her, and she's still a teenager, and she goes, I don't know what to talk about. She said, talk about every piece of clothing you have on and where you got it. I thought that was the craziest thing I ever heard, but it's a great thing. Try it sometime. You know, because everything you own, you attach some context to. And you could talk forever about the things you wear, you know, where you got it, who gave it to you, if it's a gift, blah, blah. But all our lives are made up of trifles. Everything we do, we imbue with imagination. And the act of being at a play together, where you, the lights will stay on for you, but you are going to go to the forest near Athens, I'm telling you right now, and you're going to lose yourself, and your brain is going to let you do that, and it's a trifle. It is nothing. It is just a play. But what in our worlds that we love aren't rich for being trifles? We give to things their beauty. Now, I want you to look at the first page, and I think I have just the time to do this. So I think this is one of the most mysterious speeches in Shakespeare. It's just totally, go look at it sometime for all the ways in which things you didn't expect in a poem about what's really important in this world keeps mixing the exotic, thank you so much, the supernatural, and business, and words like money and merchandise, and it's amazing, because that's what our lives are. I don't know, how many of you have an iPad? Raise your hand if you have an iPad. An iPad. You love your iPad, don't you? You love it. It's nothing. It's a piece of metal. You know, it's not a game. But there it is. I love mine. It's my iPad. I love this book. A good friend gave it to me. You can buy this book from me. Right? You can't get this book from me. Why? She can get me another one. You know, you can go. I tell you what, this old edition, you can get this thing for about 50 cents on eBay or wherever, on Amazon.com. Okay, let's look at these speeches. What I've done is underlined for you. Here it is. I've got one with the answers. It's for me. It's just so I keep myself on time. Okay, so this is all stuff about the imagination. This is the play about theater in Shakespeare. The other great play about theater in Shakespeare is Henry V, by the way. You know, where it begins with this the chorus coming out and saying, "On your imaginary forces work." Think when I talk of horses that you swim, one of the funniest lines ever written. Think when I talk of horses that you see them. What else are you going to do? Zebra. Camaro. Right, you can't not. It's just a funny line. I love it. Okay, so Theseus is talking to his new bride, the bride-to-be. And he starts, and the lovers have all waken up in the forest, and they've told this weird story. And she says, "Wow, it's weird what they say." And she says, "More strange than true. I never man believe these antique fables nor these fairy toys." I don't really go for that, fairy toys. Well, we just read a passage about a fairy who treasures her trifles. Fairy toys is what a play is, a fairy toy. You got a fairy toy tonight. Such shaping fantasies that apprehend more than cool reason, cool reason. See, so cool reason in this speech is being opposed to this fancy thing that we do. Cool, as though you can do that. So where we're going in this little thing is we're going to follow this concept of the trifle made for us by imagination and cool reason. Right? Ever compact. The lunatic, the lover, and the poet are of imagination all compact. Another, by the way, wonderful phrase, compact. You know, like it's small. Imagination's huge. But they're imagination all compact. We're all the same. Every poet is like every madman is like every lover. They're all the same. But this is what they can do. Poets, they give to airy nothing. And there we are back in those sands, the trifles. The wanton wind is airy nothing. You can't move a sailboat without airy nothing. Try it sometimes. That's how you move a sailboat. So, gives to airy nothing, a local habitation, and a name. The idea somehow that this whole world of inanimate objects cannot move without some this invisible force of our imaginations, our thoughts, us. We make things special. One sees more devils than vast hell. I won't read all of it. Local habitation, going back. Such tricks have strong imagination that it, if it but apprehends some joy, it comprehends some bringer of the joy. I don't know what the trifle was that Titania was talking about in her speech, but man, can I see her pregnant bringer of it in that speech. You see what I mean? Okay. So then we go, Hippolytus says, but all the story of the night told over, and all their minds transfigured. We're going to transfigure your mind tonight. And it wouldn't take any, I mean, I'm not saying it was great. I'm just saying your mind is great. It can get transfigured just like that, and it will get transfigured. And this combination, there's your cool reason, mind, and transfigured is imagination. There's the two things together again. However, it's going to grow to something of great constancy. There's that. There's the mind word, the constancy word, up against strange and admirable. Admirable here meaning wonderful, admirable in terms of the verb to admire, be wonderful, mirabilis. Theseus is later thinking, what's my entertainment going to be? And he's reading a description of Pyramus and Thisbe. And he says, very tragical mirth. Merry and tragical? Tedious and brief? How shall we find the concord of this discord? Well, here's an interesting thing for you. You think I'm talking about all this wonderful stuff because we're going to show you a comedy tonight. There ain't a play in Shakespeare that doesn't have both mixed together. Not one single play, you cannot find it. Some people have said to me, Othello. Oh, no. Lots of comedy in Othello. And there's even a clown, though most productions cut the clown. But there's a clown in Othello, too. So, together. Those two things. And then this, I just had to underline this. Philostrate saying this wonderful thing about the play. It's a play some 10 words long, but by 10 words, my lord, it is too long, which makes it tedious. But that's actually true about time. If you've ever been in a bad play, it'll seem like 2 days. If you've been in a good one, you'll be out in a minute, and it'll feel like a minute. So in a kind of funny way, this is about what the imagination does, too. Last week, Paul Menzer, who is the director of the graduate program, gave a talk down in Hollands about Dido. And there's a speech in Dido that our actor Renee Thornton did. It's a 164-line long speech about the fall of Troy. And Paul just did, and it's one of the great things I've seen on this stage. It was just unbelievable. And I've read that play many times, and I know the story, but you don't get to see it very much. And I've seen two productions of it, but not with an actor like Renee. And time went away. 164, to give you some idea, To Be or Not to Be is 37 lines long. So 164 lines, and time went away. Totally went away. It's amazing what the head can do. Therein doth kill himself, and then this wonderful thing, he killed himself, and it made my eyes water, but more merry tears the passion of loud laughter never shed. So, and that's a wonderful thing. You can laugh till you cry. You can laugh till you cry. I think that's kind of an interesting physiological. And then this other thing, Philostrate says, who wrote the play? Or whose play is it? Well, hard-handed men. And I go back to that image on the yellow sands. Hard-handed men that work in Athens here who never, and this is great, labored in their mind before. They don't labor in their mind. They just imagine stuff. And to show you that, I'm going to jump a little bit, make sure I get out on time. This is when we first meet them, the knock-knock when the force comes in. And they come in, and they're going to put on a play. And Bottom, who's trying to run everything, but is only one of the actors, says to Quince, the director, this is what you should do. Tell us what the play is. And Quince says, Mary, our play is the most lamentable comedy and most cruel death of Pyramus and Thisbe. And Bottom says, will you read it out loud for me, all of you? One, two, three. I'm going to read you your cue again, and when I say three, you're going to... You ready? Mary, our play is the most lamentable comedy and most cruel death of Pyramus and Thisbe. One, two, three. So he clearly knows it, right? It's a great piece of work. What a great play that is. Next thing that happens is, Quinn says, you, Nick Bottom, are set down for Pyramus. One, two, three. Sounds like Mr. Bottom is lying, doesn't it? Like he's faking that he knows it. And that's one way to play it. Like he's just showing off. But that's not my Bottom. My Bottom hears that title and has that play. Wow, it's a great play. Just hears the title. He's not lying when he says, what a great piece of work that is. Now, so who's in it? What's it about? It's perfectly logical for me for him to do that. I love it for that. And then I have a speech here because I think that the spirit of imagination in this play is embodied in the lowest character. The character so low that his name is Bottom. That's who he's a weaver. But the magic of the play is his, because all you've got to do is say the name of the play and he's there. That's not laboring in your mind. Just say it. Then you tell him a character. And he goes, well, what is that? Is it a tyrant? And he starts showing you what he'd do if you were a tyrant, because he's already imagined that. Remember the dream? How I said how we go to sleep, where we dream, and things just keep moving like that? They say, that's how his brain is. And then he goes, and then there's a girl named, oh, let me play her too. You know, actually, it's hard to play two lovers. It's a tough thing to do. Then he hears there's a lion, and he goes, a lion! And his brain is already, I want to do the lion. Let me do the lion. Let me do the lion. I want to play the lion too. Right? Let me play the lion. Because he's already there. Always. Easily there. Anyhow, so he has good fortune to get to sleep with the Queen of Fairies with a donkey head. And then he's waking up from his dream, and that's the speech I have here for you. Awaking, God's my life stolen hence and left me asleep. Oh, my God. And then he says that, I have had a most rare vision. You know, because you're remembering his dream. Have you done that? You know, you wake up and you go, oh, wait a second, what did I just dream about? Because this play really is about dreams. I have had a dream past the wit of man, and I've underlined the things about the difference between dreaming and trying to talk about it, which is the poet's work, right? Past the wit of man to say what dream it was. If a man is but an ass, and we all laugh at that because he's been an ass, but what comes after that is very important if he go about to expound that dream. Me thought, also another, I thought me what I was. There is no man can tell. Another word about discoursing. And me thought I have, but man is but a patch fool if he will offer to say what me thought I had. And then he says this thing, and people laugh at this because it's very funny. But it ain't funny in a dream. You've all done this. The eye of man hath not heard. You do hear with your eyes. The ear of man hath not seen. And believe me, you see with your ears. Man's hand is not able to taste. If any of you, is there food you don't like? I can't stand certain gooey foods. I can just feel them with my hand. I can tell you what they taste like. It's horrible. His tongue to conceive, and I can't tell you how many times before thinking I had used my tongue to conceive of something. Maybe I'm doing it now. Nor his heart to report what my dream was. That sounds stupid. It's magically not. On some level, it's magically deep and wonderful. And then he says, I know what I'll do. I had this. I'll make it into poetry. I'll make it into a play. I'll get it in our play. And this last line, I love that. Peradventure, to make it the more gracious, I shall sing it her death. That always gets a laugh because, you know, you're not supposed to sing it. Well, actually, the Elizabethans had a jig at the end of Hamlet or Lear. They did a jig. Because in theater, you can put happiness and sadness right together. And I wanted to finish with what happens next. So the men who were put on the show and they were missing Bottom because he's in the forest, you know, having whatever congress he can with the Queen of Fairies, They come, they see him, and he says, oh boy, okay, we're going to put on the play. They're worried they can't put on their play. And then he says, masters, I am to discourse wonders. And then from the stupidest character in the play. The character, by the way, gives us the theme of the play as opposed to all of what a play is really about. It's not real. But if you had to write an essay, the theme would be reason and love keep a little company together nowadays. I mean, that's the kind of theme. And guess who gets to say that? Bottom gets to say that. But he says, I am to discourse wonders, but ask me not what. For if I tell you, I am no true Athenian. They've been in the woods. They've been in Dionysus' world, not Athens with law and order and reason and discourse. They've been in the world of dream and drunkenness and lust and all those other things. And he says, I can't tell you this because if I am, I'm not a real Athenian. I cannot tell you this. Bottom, the most loquacious character in the play, says, no, I cannot tell you. And then he says what? I will tell you everything. Right as it fell out. And Quint says, let us hear, sweet Bottom. And then ultimate wisdom. Not a word. I hope you enjoy tonight. I think you will. I think you will. And it is really a play about seeing a play. And Shakespeare figured out, by the way, the perfect way to wake you up from your dream is to end a play, because, you know, that's what happens in the play itself. So enjoy yourself, and I'm glad you're here.
That was Dr. Ralph Presents A Midsummer Night's Dream, recorded for a live audience at the American Shakespeare Center's Blackfriars Playhouse in Stanton, Virginia, on April 11th, 2012. We hope you've enjoyed this podcast. You can download future installments of Dr. Ralph Presents and all our other podcasts for free at americanshakespearecenter.blogspot.com, or you can subscribe to all of the ASC's podcast offerings through the iTunes Music Store podcast directory. A Midsummer Night's Dream appears as part of the 2012 spring season at the Blackfriars Playhouse in repertory with The Winter's Tale and John Ford's Tis Pity She's a Whore. Tickets for all three shows in this season are available by calling the American Shakespeare Center's box office toll-free at 1-877-MUCH-ADO or by going online at americanshakespearecenter.com. I'm Cass Morris for the American Shakespeare Center with special thanks to recording engineer Sam Kugler. Thank you for joining us, and we'll look forward to seeing you soon at the Blackfriars Playhouse.